I haven't really woken up until I've had my McDonald's breakfast deal. And I know this is true because before breakfast, I put my phone in the refrigerator and couldn't find the keys that were already in my hand.
Nothing gets the morning going like the first sip of an iced coffee. Get any size and any flavor for 99 cents until 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. McDonald's, I'm loving it.
Welcome to Stories of Sacrifice, American POW MIA's podcast. I am your host and lead researcher, John Bearer. Welcome to today's Story of Sacrifice, American POW MIA's podcast. Today we're bringing you a story about a U.S. Navy patrol bomber, rugged, beloved, attached to VPB-111 during World War II. The plane was shot down by Japanese anti-aircraft fire over what is now known as Indonesia on 16 June 1945. The entire crew is still listed as missing in action. Efforts are being made to locate the remains of the crew of this aircraft, including the Alden P. Anders of Sutherland, Iowa, and repatriate them to their respective hometowns. Today we're going to hear from Anders' family and their mission on getting him identified.
Grew up on a farm in Sutherland, Iowa area. His parents were farmers. He was one of the later World War II vets. You know, he was born in 25, so he would have been one of the younger ones. And very good at baseball and basketball in high school, and he was quite popular. He was quite a handsome young man. And after he graduated from high school, he went to telegraphy school in Missouri and became a railroad telegrapher for the Santa Fe Railroad, which he did for a short period of time before he enlisted. He enlisted in 2nd of December 1943 in Des Moines. Prior to that, he'd gone to school down in, I believe it was Chillicothe, Missouri, for telegraphy, and then did dispatching to the Santa Fe out in Rialto, California. And then enlisted, like I said, in December of 43, and went into flight training, not as a pilot, as a crewman, a radioman. He went in as a radioman. And trained as a gunner as well, and then was assigned to VPB-111, Patrol Squadron 111, and then sent to the Pacific in February of 1945. So that's basically the background on him. Just a simple farmer's son from Iowa. What always amazes me as I've gone through this story is the fact that he had two rock-solid deferments. He could have stayed home in the back of the tractor in University County, Iowa, and nobody would have known the difference because he worked for the railroad and he was the son of a farmer, and both of them were deemed necessary industries during the war. And yeah. So if you worked in a necessary industry, you didn't have to go.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
But he did anyway.
Yeah. And so then he was assigned to the VPB-111. And he was on the Rugged Beloved. Can you tell us a little more about
Rugged Beloved?
Rugged Beloved.
The plane was one of many aircraft in that were flown by various crews in that patrol squadron. The bureau number was 38-913, and it was a B-24, consolidated B-24 Navy version, which they called the PB-4Y-1. They had another variation of that aircraft called a PB-4Y-2, which I believe, I think you're familiar with Burian O'Kane, Jeff O'Kane's uncle.
Yeah.
He was on a privateer. They called that a privateer. They basically took the same plane and then put a single tail on it instead of the double tail that you have in the B-24. But Alden's plane was the PB-4Y-1, which is the standard B-24. Had a nose, a chin turret on it, and a crew normally of 10, although there were 11 that day on this particular flight. And I've never been able to establish quite why there were three officers that day. You had a pilot, co-pilot, but then there was another ensign on there. And I've always wondered. In fact, he was the only one that was identified after the crash. His name was Philip Stretcher. He was from Oregon. And was identified circumstantially because his body was clothed in a flight jacket with his name on it. But he is buried at Punch Bowl in a marked grave, obviously. The rest of the crew is were unknown. And they were deemed recoverable after the war.
What do you know about the circumstances of their last mission and what led to their MIA status?
So they were on a routine interdiction flight down the Makassar Strait in the Netherlands East Indies, which is, of course, now is the country of Indonesia. Makassar Straits are between the Isle of Sulawesi and then, you know, Indonesia is composed of many islands as well as the main part of the country. And they were tasked with finding Japanese assets and dealing with them, getting rid of them. And they were very good with them. The crew had several commendations for taking out Japanese assets. But they were to fly the straits, basically a long, boring mission. It was like over 1,000 miles out and 1,000 miles back. And toward the end of the war, they lengthened those missions. And for some reason, we're not quite sure, maybe never will know, why Lieutenant J.G. Bass decided to fly around the end of Sulawesi province and toward the city of Makassar, but he did. There was a Japanese naval presence there, and they came in to strafe and bomb in the bay, the Japanese ships that were there, and they took anti-aircraft fire in the first pass, and they took a hit amidships. But the engines were still good, apparently. They went back up into the clouds. About 10 minutes later, they came back again, low level, to do another strafe and bombing run, and they nailed them in the cockpit, and the plane went down. And so the plane went into the bay. Japanese sent out a search party with a skiff and some hooks trying to figure out, you know, find anything they could in the wreckage. They came back. They didn't have anything. The bay isn't that deep, but it must have been deep enough where it was not worth their time to go trying to dive in the wreck. And then subsequently on, I believe it was the 17th, the shoot down was on the 16th. On the 17th, five bodies washed up on the breakwater in front of Makassar City. They were recovered by indigenous citizens there and taken to a Christian cemetery and buried. And then the next day, four more bodies washed up on the breakwater. And then they reported that one long, tall, slender, blonde person, that's Ensign Stretcher, was taken away. So apparently he must have survived. The thought is that he was taken, I believe the Japanese called their Gestapo the Kempeitai or something to that effect.
Yeah, the Kempeitai, yeah.
They were known to be fairly brutal. And I'm guessing, although I cannot find any record in the, there was a prison camp at Makassar City, Allied prison camp, which had a lot of prisoners in it. A lot of the survivors of the USS Houston, which was sunk in 42, and then the USS Pope, some of those survivors. But then they also had Dutch, British, Allied personnel as well, but I've searched those records from that prison camp, and I can find no reference to Stretcher whatsoever. I don't know if it was just a clerical overlook. I think things by June 1945 for the Japanese were pretty chaotic as far as just, you know, they were hanging on by their teeth in the Pacific, especially on these outposts like this where they were not getting resupplied. And so I'm thinking that probably, you know, he may have just been overlooked. In any case, they did bury him, sans head, in a in the same Christian cemetery, but they had a marker over his grave. The other ten guys, actually, after the war, Graves Registration went in and they retrieved six caskets. And they moved those caskets to, they tried to do dental comparison, and it was just not possible, I guess. And so they designated them with a case file number, moved the six caskets to India, to the American Military Cemetery at Barakapur. And they stayed there until 1947, when again they were exhumed, and they again tried dental identification, again proved inconclusive. And so they put them on a ship, and they sent them to Punchbowl for permanent burial. So they're and during that second exhumation, they discovered that there were four sets of remains in one of the caskets. So they separated them all out. So we have these X157, 165, 166, A, B, or 168, A, B, C, and D, and then the other two up to 171. They're not sequential, but that's not important. They took them to Punchbowl, and that's where we believe they are now.
So that kind of gets us into your case that you've got working with the DPAA, and kind of what you've done on finding all the crew members and stuff, the families of the crew members.
That was an interesting process. I was on Ancestry? No, it was findagrave.com one night, and just perusing through, just not looking for nothing in particular, but I typed in Alden's name to see what they had on him. Well, lo and behold, they had this whole story about him, but about half of it was inaccurate. So I went in and I corrected this story in the Find a Grave. And about an hour later, I got an email from a fellow in New York City metro area. He actually lived in New Jersey. His name is Mark Chimachita. And Mark is a retired FBI man whose specialty is finding people. And so I gave him an entire list of the crew. And within another hour, I'm getting addresses and phone numbers of next of kin back. I'm going, wow, this is incredible. And so I composed a cover letter explaining the entire thing, what I was doing. And I contacted initially eight of the families.
Everybody needs just the right amount of fuel to get going in the morning. For some, a nice McDonald's egg and cheese bagel is just enough to do it. Others might prefer a McDonald's bacon egg and cheese bagel. Or perhaps a sausage egg and cheese bagel. And there are those where nothing will do but a hearty McDonald's steak egg and cheese bagel. Four different breakfast bagels to get you going. Tomorrow morning, give your engine a head start at participating McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
One of the crew members, AOM-3 George Pringle, was an only child. His parents were only children. And so he is the one crew member who I have no contact with at all. But thanks to your help, I now have contact information for Roger Mitchell's next of kin. I'm in regular contact with the pilot's son, Lewis Bass. When he was deployed to the Pacific, he had been married, and his wife was pregnant when he went to the Pacific, and his son, Lon, who now is his last name is Wyatt, his mother remarried, Lon Wyatt, lives near San Francisco, and he is the pilot's son. He's the pilot, obviously, he never knew his father, and so I'm in contact with him. And then have contacted next of kin of all but two, and they're hopefully, I believe all of them, at least eight of them now have submitted reference samples to the DPAA. So at this point, what I would like to see happening, because in the first DPAA family meeting, I was told, and I've got it here in front of me in black and white, that you have to have 60% reference samples on file with the DPAA before they'll consider doing an exhumation of those particular file numbers. So I believe we've achieved that, and I would like to go on at that point, because right now I've done all I can do. There's nothing more that I can do. I think I know where they're at. I think they're at Punchbowl. one of the most troubling things all along to me was, why no dog tags? There doesn't seem to be any reference to, in any of this, of any dog tags. I mean, you're going to the military, you get a set of dog tags. What happened to them? You know, would they, I mean, sure, you know, things happen in a crash, but certainly not all 11 crew members lost their dog tags. It just, it's not plausible.
Right. What were the, did you ever receive any, individual deceased personnel files on Alden?
I did. Yeah.
And yes, there's no reference to it or anything?
No reference to dog tags or anything like that. No, I have, in fact, I have that, and I also have the, all of the correspondence, which went on for years. I have letters between the Anders family and the Navy dating up all the way to 1967. And the Navy balked at awarding him his medal for some reason. I don't know that reason. My mother-in-law, who actually lives with us, she's 88, but she was only 12 years old at the time. And she said, you know, when in those days, parents just didn't include you in those discussions. So she really has, she's in the dark. She just really doesn't know why that would have happened. But he does have a marker, and it's right next to his parents in this little cemetery called Lone Tree Cemetery in Sioux Rapids, Iowa, a beautiful little town above the Sioux River. And there's a marker there with Alden's name on it, and it says, you know, missing in action, and then the awards that he earned, the medal, which they eventually did get the medal. But they're just, you know, this whole thing started for me in 1983 when I was at a birthday party for Alden's mother. She lived to be quite old. In fact, she lived to be 100. And I was at her 100th birthday party, and everybody's standing around eating their cake, me included. And I was standing there, had my very small infant daughter and my son. And one of her friends puttered up to her, also very old, and said, "So you're so wealthy. What would you like for your birthday?" And she looked her straight in the eye. I mean, wealthy at 100 years old, had all of her noodles. And I mean, she was a smart cookie, and she was smart as a razor even at that point in her life. She looked right in the eye and she said, "I've always wanted to know what happened to my son."
Yeah, that's...
And that, I heard that and I just thought, wow. Now we're talking at that point over 50 years on, and this was the number one thing in her mind still. So that's pretty powerful, really is.
Yeah, it is.
And so that's got what got me interested in it, got me starting to research what happened and doing all of this.
So he's still got two siblings that are still living. He's got your mother-in-law, and then he's got a brother that's right. Still alive.
He has a brother who's now living with his daughter in Waterloo, Iowa, and his name is Merwin Anders. And Merwin is 90, let's see, Colleen's 88. Merwin would be 92. Yeah, because he was 2 years younger than Alden. Alden was born in 24, and Merwin would have been born in 26. Merwin never served. He was just a little bit too young, still in high school when the war ended.
Yeah, he kind of missed that between World War II and the Korea thing. Yeah, he was kind of in that age right in between them.
Right. Yes, he was. So he's not in the best of health, but he also submitted a reference sample. In fact, we have about 8 reference samples for Alden, including a sister and a brother. So that's a pretty good match.
Yeah, they should be able to get Y-DNA and mitochondrial. So that's good.
Yeah. And most of the other families have done, you know, I have a family reference sample from a son, obviously, Lewis Bass, and or Lon Weiss, Lewis Bass's son, and the other families as well. So we're hoping, the point we're at now is that, well, somebody's going to get a call. And, you know, they are systematically exhuming all of the unknown graves at Punch Bowl as we speak. I think their priority for the longest time was the Oklahoma, USS Oklahoma fatalities, which I think they've identified now at this point, something over 400 of the 422. They're over 400 now, which is extraordinary, really is. But there's something like 38,000 unknowns at Punch Bowl, and it's going to take a while to get through them. So this may happen in my lifetime. My son, my grandson might get the call.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, when you're working with your casualty officer from the Navy, have you actually asked them to go ahead and put in for a disinterment authorization now that you've met the threshold?
I have not at this point. I did a virtual family day last October, which was a little disconcerting because the guys were started backing away from all the, what I'm looking at now. He started backing away and he was saying, well, those guys could have been any guys because there were all kinds of Allied personnel. There were over six other B-24s shot down. Well, gee, I'm sorry. Did they all just coincidentally wash up on the beach the day after the Rugged Beloved went down? Come on. You know. And, I mean, the guy was just really, in fact, my mother-in-law was sitting right next to me. We're doing a online meeting with them. And she was getting a little hot under the collar. I mean, because what he was telling us this last October wasn't jiving at all with the file that I was given in New Orleans in 2016. And so it just kind of left a bad taste in my mouth. I mean, I have the greatest respect and appreciation for the task that these people have. It's finding a needle in a stack of needles. I realize that. But to just summarily kind of dismiss what they told me in 2016 seemed quite odd to me.
Yeah, it's actually a pretty common theme here lately. I'm working with another family. We're on some guys that went missing during the Bataan Death March in the Philippines. And they went, sure. You know, we've got it narrowed down to seven or eight graves that these guys were in. And, the family included me in on their conference call or Zoom call with the DPAA here in May. And now the DPAA wants to add another 200 names to that list. So,
wow.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Your relative perished in the Bataan Death March, correct?
Say that again.
Your relative. You had a relative in the Bataan Death March.
Yeah, correct? He survived the march. And then,
oh, he did?
Yeah, he made it to Camp O'Donnell. Then he was put out on a POW detail where they had to go back down on the Bataan Peninsula and collect scrap metal so that they're collect up all the metal from the fighting and stuff. And Japan was sending that metal back to Japan to recycle it for the war effort. But he ended up dying in one of the POW camps.
Wow.
Everybody needs just the right amount of fuel to get going in the morning. For some, a nice McDonald's egg and cheese bagel is just enough to do it. Others might prefer a McDonald's bacon egg and cheese bagel. Or perhaps a sausage egg and cheese bagel. And there are those where nothing will do but a hearty McDonald's steak egg and cheese bagel. Four different breakfast bagels to get you going. Tomorrow morning, give your engine a head start at participating McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
So, yeah. Were you ever able to determine his status?
I was. He was listed as missing in action up until the late 50s, and then they were finally able to, through dental and the dental information and stuff like that, they finally made an identification on him. But he was lucky enough to be buried in an isolated grave by himself. He wasn't commingled with any others. So
sure.
They were able to piece it together.
If the DPA, did they go into, because Japanese had prison camps all over Southwest Asia. And I mean, in fact, I had a Hiddle relative that actually died in a prison camp in Burma. And I didn't know if the government even bothered to go and exhume those cemeteries after the war.
They did. The American Graves Registration, AGRS, actually went through the Pacific. They were assigned to the Pacific side of things. And they did go through all those different camps and actually disinter a lot of those remains. All the unknowns most of the unknowns from the Pacific campaign are all located at the Manila American Cemetery. And then there are a few located there at the Punch Bowl.
Right, and that's where Alden's name's actually on the walls of Michigan, Manila.
Yeah, correct. So, yeah.
The whole crew actually is.
Yeah. And it showed that their remains were all transferred to the Punch Bowl, correct? Isn't that what you were saying?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, they took all of these case files that they were assigned, and they were, from what I understand, they were not kept together at all. They simply exhumed these caskets at Barakapur, India, and just shipped them back to Honolulu. No particular order, were not buried in any particular order. Because I thought, well, gee, some of these numbers are sequential. They can't be that far from each other. But I said, no, that's just a case file. That's all it is. And the case file, of course, is on the unknown marker on top of the grave. But where are they in the cemetery? Well, they could be anywhere in the cemetery amongst the 38,000.
Yeah. So, exactly. So, yeah, If it was personally me, this is just on a side note, you know, if I was handling your case, I would actually be contacting your Navy casualty office and asking them to that the family wants a disinterment authorization submitted. And,
I think so at this point, I need to go ahead and do that. My problem is that the families have told me they've submitted them, but I don't have proof that they actually did. It's very difficult to get a hold of the DPAA. I mean, I've tried calling, I think it's in Millington, Tennessee is where that office is at. And it's nigh on impossible to get a hold of a live person there. But there must be some kind of a form I have to fill out to do that, correct?
Well, you can actually just submit it in an email to your caseworker. Say you want a disinterment authorization submitted on behalf of, you know, you're on all
our X files.
Yeah, exactly. And okay. You know, they have up to, you know, the DPA will then they'll route that to the DPAA, and then DPAA will take a look at it, and their historians will look at the relook at the case. And if they feel that they've got enough evidence that that is the crew and the family reference sample threshold's been met, they'll submit that disinterment authorization to the Department of Defense. And the Department of Defense will make the final authorization on whether or not they'll disinter those sets of remains from that case.
Sure.
So it'll actually move that forward for your family and hopefully get an answer back one way or another what their ideas are on where this crew is.
True. Well, the other thing that concerns me is the present administration doesn't seem to have a particular affinity for the military. And that I'm a little worried about because, you know, I mean, they're anti-American. I'm sorry.
Right. I don't disagree.
That's my feeling.
Yeah. I don't disagree either. And
I don't think they really much care.
Right. And, you know, these policies that the DPAA has is like working through a bureaucratic nightmare, you know, trying to get answers back and forth between them and the families. And it's, you know, you expect you could be able to pick up a phone, make a phone call, say, hey, what's going on with this case? But it's not that way. It takes months and months before they even respond in a lot of cases. So. I really feel for what you guys are going through, and I do want to.
Well, it would be really nice, you know, especially since Alden does have a sister and a brother still surviving, and until last year he had another sister. She died at 98, you know, my ideal scenario was for them to identify him before Lois died, his older sister. He was number two in the family, and Lois was number one. He was the second oldest, and then Merwin, and then Colleen. But it's like I said, I facing reality here now and realizing that this is not something that happens overnight. This takes, in a lot of cases, years. But, you know, every day I read about a new one, you know. I taught for 4 years in rural Iowa, and I saw the other day where a sailor from one of these little towns I taught at was identified. He was on the crew of the Oklahoma, and they identified him, and they took him home this week.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah, and I mean, it can't happen. It just takes years. The process, their process, is years and years. I mean, you can.
And again, you know, cannot realize what a difficult task this is. You know, would be wrong on my part, and I do. I have a great deal of respect for them and what they're doing. It's terribly difficult work. It's tedious work. It takes time, and that's the hardest part, is waiting for the time, you know, to pass or to come to a resolution.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was going to bring up too, you had me do a bunch of pictures and stuff for you with that app from MyHeritage, and you know, they do sponsor, you know, kind of what I'm doing here. And I had animated one photo of Alden, and you had said you had sent it to his brother. What was his reaction to that?
Sherry said that, you know, they opened it up and it said, like, our heart stopped. It's like just amazing, you know, to see those eyes move and to see that, you know, the smile. And it was just quite emotional for both of them. Very emotional.
Yeah, I bet it was after 80-some years or 70-some years and finally...
76 years this year.
Being able to see some movement of it. Yeah, that's...
Yeah. And he was, like I said, he was a very happy-go-lucky, very outgoing type of guy. I was able to contact an interesting thing about this whole process has been accumulating the side stories to go along with this. And so after I had pretty much done all I could as far as contacting the crew and asking them, crew members next of kin, and asking them to submit family reference samples, next I started collecting stories from each of the families. And some of the stories are absolutely fantastic. Well, first of all, the big news is that practically every family was told something different by the Navy. One family was told that the plane went down over the Sea of Japan. We're talking 1,000 miles away.
Yeah.
another family was just said lost at sea. And of course, my mother-in-law, being only 11 or 12 at the time, remembers that she said her parents were told that he was lost near Madagascar. Madagascar? Well, of course, that got more, if that was a child's recollection, okay, and that was actually Macassar. But, yeah, they were all told substantially different stories in some cases about, because they didn't really know. They sent out a search plane the day after they didn't come back, but they didn't search where they actually went down. All they did was run the straits, because that was the mission. And nobody knows why Bass decided he needed to go over Macassar. There was no reason that day. All he needed to do was fly that 1,200 miles out, 1,200 miles back to Palawan, packing in for the day, head off to the bar, go see a movie, right? Yeah. But he didn't. But some of the more interesting stories involving some of the crew. Oh, what's his name here? Let me thumb back here a minute. Oh, yeah. Okay. Where's his name at here? Okay, Henry Philpott. His name was Verlin, AMM-1. He was the crew chief on the plane. This guy was at Pearl Harbor, December 7th. He was in the Navy already. He was with VP-111 at Pearl Harbor and then went off to the European theater, where he flew the Mediterranean from 41 all the way through 44. And was brought back after the Germans capitulated in May of 45, was brought back for redeployment to the Pacific. Well, he got back to his hometown and took his sister aside and says, look, you need to prepare mom because I'm not coming back from this one.
Wow.
Yeah. And he has quite a colorful history. His grandfather, Henry Philpott's grandfather, was the first U.S. Secret Service agent.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I know the name. Okay.
His grandfather fought with Teddy Roosevelt in his division in the Spanish-American War, the Rough Riders.
Rough Riders, yep.
And so the story that was told by the family is that, you know, Philpott used to brag around town, hey, you know, when Roosevelt was elected president in 1908, I believe, 1909, he was bragging around town, hey, I know this guy, I served with him. And of course, everybody's going, oh, right, sure, uh-huh. You know the president. Are you still there, John?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay. Little town in Kentucky, everybody's going, right, okay. Nobody believed him. Well, the president came to Lexington, Kentucky, to give a speech after his inauguration. And, of course, he and several of the townspeople was nearby to them. They all wanted to see the president. So they all piled up and went up to Lexington to see the president. And they were lucky enough, Philpott was lucky enough to get a front row seat. And then the president got up to speak, and he looked out over the crowd, and he looked down, and he said, Philpott, you old scoundrel, you. And it was old home week, and then, of course, an immediate vindication with all his townspeople, like, oh, my God, they spoke to him. And then came down afterwards and gave him a big hug and said, look, we've got this new program that we're starting in Washington called the United States Secret Service. And he served for Roosevelt's bodyguard for the rest of his term.
I'll be. That's pretty neat.
Yeah. So that's Verlin Philpott's grandfather. And then Lieutenant J.G. William Dernberger from Mattawan, New Jersey. Now, Mark Timotita, the guy that found out all the names for him, he lives just down the street from where this family lived in Mattawan, New Jersey. He presently lived there. But Bill Dernberger went out and bought a near-new Cadillac. It was a 1940 model. Of course, they weren't making any cars during the war because of the war production. But he took this near-new Cadillac, parked it in his parents' garage. And this car never moved until the mid-80s when the parents died.
Oh, no.
Never turned a wheel.
Wow.
I think they sat there thinking, yeah, he's going to come down up that driveway, drive it away. He was engaged to be married when he left. And then there it is. And Mark talks about how neighborhood kids would get down there and look through the glass of that garage at this beautiful car sitting in there. And then eventually, after they passed away, they towed it out of there. Somebody got a real nice car.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, collector's item there.
So the side stories are just, a lot of them are kind of heart-rendering. Joseph Regiak, AR-3, another gunner on the crew, another radioman. There were five radiomen on the crew. And I believe that Robert Graham, he would have been the first-class radioman, so he would have been the radio guy. The rest of them were all gunners. But Joseph Regiak was from Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. And after his family got the news, his sister got married the next spring. And she wore, instead of flowers at the wedding, she wore his air wings. And she forbid anybody to dance at the reception because he was a great dancer. And she wouldn't let anybody dance. And so there was no dancing at her wedding reception.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And Ray Kivett, ARM3, another ARM3, his family received a box of his possessions that the Navy sent back. And his mother absolutely screamed when it came and would not open it. She said, no, it's not true. She was in a state of denial for some time and just refused to believe it. And then nobody ever opened that box. And the family, unfortunately, lost track of it when they sold the house. And they don't know. They think she stuck it back in the closet. And it may have gotten pitched. Who knows?
Right.
But it's too bad because they have nothing that belonged to him, you know. And then I've had some compelling conversations with Lon White about his father that he never knew. And a very curious sense of almost responsibility. Why did my dad do that day? Why did he go over there when he didn't have to go over there? Why did he go over to Macassar and start shooting things up?
Yeah, it's
who knows?
Probably something will never be answered. I mean, he could have spotted, you know, a jab zero and followed it and to see what, you know, it could have been most anything.
But oddly enough, you know, that when I sense this feeling that he feels some kind of responsibility for this because it was his father. But it's very strange indeed. But, you know, and he's, you know, every once in a while I'll get an email from Lon and he'll say, well, what, if, you know, why do you, maybe he did it because of this. And, but his middle name was Tulane, Louis Tulane Bass. And he actually is, his grandfather was one of the founders of Tulane University in New Orleans.
Oh, no kidding.
And, yeah. And in fact, the family still owns a house. The Bass family still owns a house on St. Charles Avenue in New Orleans.
Oh, wow.
But, so these are some of the side stories, you know, that I've accumulated, and it's been interesting. It really has.
Did Arden ever write any letters home that you guys still have?
I have a letter. Let me bring this letter up here. Alden wrote a letter on June 15th, 1945. They were shot down. You want to hear it?
Yes, definitely.
Dear folks, I guess I've been neglecting writing to you here lately, but we're all okay. I haven't heard from you for quite some time. How does the new farm all tractor work? How many knots will it do? Ha ha. Bert Beebe, one of my buddies here, is going back to the States. He said he would drop you a line. We went to the movies tonight. It was the same sort of spy picture, and I didn't like it so well. We have to carry our own chairs to the movies, and by the time you get there with them, we're all exhausted. I suppose they're all metal chairs. Next one. Okay, so this is, keep in mind, written on June 15th. Thing went down on the 16th. Don't count on me coming home too soon. We won't know until the last minute. It will be a while yet. But be sure to have the car in good shape, so the radio working and it has four good tires on it. There isn't much to say, and I have to close and hit the sack. We'll write more often. With love, Alden.
Yeah, day before he went down.
Day before he went down. June 15th. Wow. It's just, it's pretty, pretty compelling. I was able to contact a member of VTC 117, a gentleman named Ted Carpenter, who lives up in the Iowa Great Lakes area at Milford, Iowa. And he became friends with Alden quite by accident when they were taking their training in Memphis. They took training in Memphis and I believe radio training in Farragut, Idaho. But when they were in Memphis, Ted Carpenter, who I called a couple years ago, and he was 96 or 97 at the time, and had a nice little interview with him, which I recorded. But he said he was walking through the barracks one day, and he saw this guy laying on his bunk, and he had a copy of the Spencer, Iowa newspaper. And he said, "Hey, man, I'm from Spencer, Iowa. How'd you get that?" And then, you know, so he had two guys that grew up less than 20 miles from each other and never knew each other, and they met in the Navy. And they became good friends after that.
Yeah.
And, but he said, you know, I asked him, I said, "Did you know Bass?" He said, "Oh yeah, everybody knew Bass." Okay. Tell me about Bass. Excuse me. So anyway, Ted said, his words in the interview I had with him, he said, "Bass with a hot dog. He was going to be a hero." He said, my commander of my plane said, "Look, I'm not taking any chances. My job is to get you home to your mamas." But he said, Bass was going to be a hero. And it was just, that was in his mindset. So I found that kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But, and that's probably why he did it that day, you know. That's probably why he did it. He figured, well, get us another air medal here. But Alden had an air medal with two gold stars. And I was personally credited with sinking four Japanese vessels.
Oh, no kidding. Wow.
Yeah. Now, he's shooting twin 50s, so we're not talking ships here necessarily, but small supply vessels and things like that. But still, it was a vessel.
Yeah. But, it counted toward and, the touch.
Yeah. And other members of the crew also were, you know, we had air medals with gold stars as well. But, so I've got quite a little file built up here. It's And then I have a Facebook page. If anybody's interested, it's just simply go to Facebook in memory of the crew of the Rugged Beloved, Rugged Beloved. And on this, I've posted just tons of stuff. These incidental stories that go along with it, as well as just the facts of the whole incident.
Yeah, and I'll make sure there's going to be links in the show notes here on this podcast where people can click on the link and go to that Facebook page and find you.
Wonderful.
So, well, what's the next steps for the families? Where do you think you're going to go from here?
Well, again, pretty much if everybody has submitted their family reference sample, now the waiting game begins. There's really nothing more that we can do substantially that will make this process move along any faster than it is. I mean, it is what it is right now. We've got the family reference samples, and now all we've got to do is get them out of the ground so they can take DNA samples and see if there's a match.
Yeah, that's where the struggle's going to begin.
So. And like I said, I mean, that could be, it might happen yet during my lifetime. I'm 65 years old. You know, it's not going to, may not, probably not going to happen in my lifetime. Although my dream has always been to play taps for the funeral for Alden, you know, since I'm a musician.
Oh, yeah.
But I don't think that's going to happen. Like I said, it could be my son that gets the call. He's 35. It could be my grandson who's 3.
Right.
But we'll keep it alive in the family, and when I get too old to start drooling in my soup and need to have help, I'll pass it on to my son, and maybe he'll pass it on to his son.
Eagle soars above our land, flags so proudly hailed. Be proud of this America. Realize. Bring our missing man back home, prisoners of war. MIA's America. What are we waiting for? Bring them home. Bring them home. Eagle flies in chains until we have them home again. Eagle flies in chains.
They say that home is where the heart is. Maybe that's why so many fall in love with Big Pine Key in Florida's Lower Keys. With epic ocean views, unspoiled wilderness, sandy beaches, abundant wildlife, RV resorts, and Stock Island's rustic charm, Florida's Lower Keys don't skip a beat. For more about the Lower Keys and the latest safety protocols, visit flakeys.com/lowerkeys.
I haven't really woken up until I've had my McDonald's breakfast deal. And I know this is true because before breakfast, I put my phone in the refrigerator and couldn't find the keys that were already in my hand.
Nothing gets the morning going like the first sip of an iced coffee. Get any size and any flavor for 99 cents until 11 a.m. Price and participation may vary.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. McDonald's. I'm loving it.